and a spur to the faithful servants of truth and justice. Arm yourselves and be ye men of valor, and be in readiness for the conflict, for it is better for us to perish in battle than to look upon the outrage of our nation and our altars. As the will of God is in heaven, even so let him do.
The disastrous military events which have happened in France during the last fortnight have not come to me with any sense of surprise. Indeed, I told the House of Commons, as you may remember, almost exactly a fortnight ago, that the worst possibilities were open. And I made it perfectly clear that whatever happened in France would make no difference to the resolve of Britain and the British Empire to fight on. As I then said, if necessary for years, if necessary alone. During the last few days, we have successfully brought off the great majority of the troops we had on the lines of communication in France. And 7/8 of all the troops we have sent to France since the beginning of the war, that is to say about 350,000 out of 400,000 men, are safely back in this country. Others are still fighting with the French. We have also brought back a great mass of stores, rifles and munitions of all kinds, which had been accumulated in France during the last 9 months. We have therefore in this island today a very large and powerful military force. This force includes all our best trained troops and our finest troops, including scores of thousands of those who have already measured their quality against the Germans and found themselves at no disadvantage. We have under arms at the present time in this island over a million and a quarter men. Behind these, we have the local defense volunteers, numbering 500,000, only a portion of whom, however, are yet armed with rifles or other firearms. We have incorporated into our defense forces every man for whom we have a weapon. We expect very large additions to our weapons in the near future. And in preparation for this, we intend forthwith to call up, drill, and train further large numbers. Those who are not called up, or else are employed upon the vast business of munitions production in all its branches, and their ramifications are innumerable, those who are not so employed or required will serve the country best by remaining at their ordinary work until they receive their summons. We have also over here the Dominion armies. The Canadians have actually landed in France, but have now been safely withdrawn. They were much disappointed, but in perfect order with all their artillery and equipment. And both these very high-class forces from the Dominions will now take part in the defense of the mother country. Lest the account I have given of these large forces we have in this country should raise the question, why did they not intervene in the Battle of France? I must make it clear that apart from the divisions training and organizing at home, only 12 divisions were equipped to fight upon the scale which justified their being sent abroad. And this was fully up to the number which the French had been led to expect would be available at the 9th month of the war. The rest of our forces have a fighting value for home defense, which will, of course, steadily increase with every week that passes. Thus, the invasion of Great Britain would at this time require the transportation across the sea of hostile armies on a very large scale. And after they had been transported, they would have to be continually maintained with all the immense mass of munitions and supplies which are required for continuous battle. As continuous battle it will surely be. Now here is where we come to the Navy. After all, we have a Navy. Some people are inclined to forget that we have a Navy. For more than 30 years, I've been concerned in discussions about the possibilities of overseas invasion. And I took the responsibility on behalf of the Admiralty at the beginning of the last war of allowing all the regular troops to be sent out of the country. That was a very serious step to take because our territorials had only just been called up and were quite untrained. Therefore, this island was for several months practically denuded of fighting troops. The Admiralty of those days had confidence in their ability to prevent a mass invasion. And you must remember that at that time, the Germans had a magnificent battle fleet, a fleet in the proportion of 10 ships of theirs to 16 of ours, and capable of fighting a general engagement any day. Whereas now they have only two heavy ships worth speaking of, the Scharnhorst and the Neisenau. So the situation is very much less critical than the one we lived through in the beginning of the last war. And it seems to me that so far as seaborne invasion on a great scale is concerned, we are far more capable of meeting it today than we were at many periods in the last war. And during the early months of this war also, and while the BEF had proceeded abroad. Now, the Navy have never pretended to be able to prevent raids by bodies of 5,000 or 10,000 men flung suddenly across and thrown ashore at several points of the coast, some dark night or foggy morning. The efficacy of sea power, and especially under modern conditions, depends upon the invading force being of a large size, so that the Navy have something they can find and meet, and as it were, something they can bite on. Now even five divisions, very lightly equipped, would require 200 to 250 ships, and with the modern air reconnaissance and photography, it would not be easy to collect such an armada, marshal it and conduct it across the sea without any powerful naval force to escort it, and there would be very great possibilities, to put it mildly, that this armada would be intercepted long before it reached the coast and all the men drowned in the sea, or at the worst blown to pieces with their equipment while they were trying to land. We have also a great system of minefields recently strongly reinforced, through which we alone know the channels. If the enemy tries to sweep passages through these minefields, it will be the task of the Navy to destroy the minesweepers and any other force employed to protect them. There ought to be no difficulty in this, owing to our great superiority at sea. The question is whether there are any new methods by which these solid assurances can be circumvented. Odd as it may seem, some attention has been given to this by the Admiralty, whose prime duty and responsibility it is to destroy any large seaborne expedition before it reaches, or at the moment it reaches, these shores. It wouldn't be a good thing for me to go into details of this. I might put something in their minds which they haven't thought of. And perhaps they wouldn't make any answer which would put something in our minds that we haven't thought of. All I will say is that untiring vigilance and untiring searching of the mind is being and must be devoted to the subject. Because remember, the enemy is crafty, cunning, and full of novel treacheries and stratagems. There is no dirty trick he will not do. This brings me to the great question of invasion from the air and of the impending struggle between the British and German air forces. It seems quite clear that no invasion on a scale beyond the capacity of our land forces to crush speedily, no invasion on a scale beyond that is likely to take place until our air force has been definitely overpowered. In the meantime, there may be raids by parachute troops and attempted descents by airborne soldiers. We ought to be able to give these gentry a warm reception, both in the air and also if they reach the ground in any condition to continue the discussion. But the great question is, can we break Hitler's air weapons? Now, of course, it is a very great pity that we have not got an air force at least equal to that of the most powerful enemy within reach of our shores. We were promised that 5 years ago. But we have a very powerful air force, which has proved itself far superior in quality, both in men and in many types of machines, to anything we have met so far in the numerous and fierce air battles which have been fought with the Germans. In France, where we were at a considerable disadvantage, and lost a lot of machines on the ground when they were standing round the aerodromes. In France, we were accustomed to inflict in the air a loss of 2 to 2.5 to 1. In the fighting over Dunkirk, which was a sort of no man's land, we undoubtedly beat the German Air Force and gained the mastery of the inflicting here a loss of 3 or 4 to 1, day after day. Anyone who looked at the photographs, you must remember them, of the re-embarkation about 10 days ago, great photographs in all the papers, showing the masses of troops assembled upon the beaches, forming the ideal target for hours at a time. Anyone who looked at them must realize that this could not have been possible, that the re-embarkation of all these men could never have been achieved unless the enemy had resigned all hope of recovering air superiority at that time and at that place. In the defense of this island, the advantages of the defenders will be much greater than they were in the fighting around Dunkirk. We hope to improve upon the rate of 3 or 4 to 1, which was realized at Dunkirk, and in addition, all injured machines and their crews which get down safely, which there are a great many in air fighting, surprisingly, quite a large number, come to ground without being permanently injured, and quite a large number of the men come to ground safely. If they fall on friendly soil, they live to fight another day, whereas all the injured enemy machines and all the men who man them will be total losses so far as the war is concerned. During the great battle in France, we gave very powerful continuous aid to the French army, both by fighters and by bombers. But in spite of every kind of pressure, we would never allow the entire metropolitan strength of the air force in fighters to be consumed. This decision was painful, but it was also right, because the fortunes of the battle in France could not have been decisively influenced even if we had thrown in our entire air fighter force. That great battle was lost by the unfortunate strategic opening, by the extraordinary unforeseen power of the armored columns, and by the very great German preponderance in numbers. Our fighter air force might easily have been exhausted as a mere incident in that conflict. And then we should have found ourselves at the present time in a serious plight indeed. As it is, I'm happy to inform you that our fighter air strength is stronger at the present time relatively to the Germans, who have suffered terrible losses, than it has ever been. And that consequently we believe ourselves possessed of the capacity to continue the war in the air under better conditions than we have ever experienced before. I look forward confidently to the exploits of our fighter pilots, these splendid men, this brilliant youth, who will have the glory of saving their native land, their island home, and all they love from the most deadly of all attacks. There remains, of course, the danger of the bombing attacks, which will certainly be made very soon upon us by the numerous bomber forces of the enemy. It is quite true that their bomber force is superior in numbers to ours. But we have a very large bomber force also, which we shall use to strike at military targets in Germany without intermission. I do not at all underrate the severity of the ordeal which lies before us, but I believe our countrymen will show themselves capable of standing up to it and of carrying on in spite of it, at least as well as any other people in the world. Much will depend on this, and every man and woman will have the chance to show the finest qualities of their race and to render the highest service to their cause. For all of us, whatever our sphere or station, it will be a help to think of the famous lines, "He nothing common did or mean," upon that memorable scene. I have thought it right on this occasion to give you some indication of the solid practical ground upon which we base our inflexible resolve to continue the war. There are a good many people who say, "Never mind, win or lose, sink or swim, better die than submit to tyranny, and such a tyranny." And I do not dissociate myself from them. But I can assure you that our professional advisors of the three services, very able men, unitedly advise us that we should carry on the war, that we are able to carry on the war, and that there are good and reasonable hopes of final victory. We have fully informed and consulted all the self-governing divisions, these great communities far beyond the ocean, who have been built up on our laws and on our civilization, and who are absolutely free to choose their course, but are absolutely devoted to the ancient motherland, and who feel themselves inspired by the same emotions which lead us to stake our all upon duty and honor. We have fully consulted them, and I have received from their Prime Minister, Mr. Mackenzie King of Canada, Mr. Menzies of Australia, and Mr. Fraser of New Zealand, and the great General Smuts of South Africa, that wonderful man, with his immense, profound mind and his eye watching from the distance the whole panorama of European affairs. I've received from all these eminent men who all have governed on wide franchises, who are all there because they represent the will of their people. I've received from them messages couched in the most moving terms. They endorse cordially our decision to fight on, and they declare themselves ready to share our fortune and to persevere to the end. That is what we are going to do. We may now ask ourselves, in what way has our position worsened since the beginning of the war? It has been worsened by the fact that the Germans have conquered a large part of the coastline of Western Europe, and many small countries have been overrun by them. This aggravates the possibilities of air attack and adds to our naval preoccupation. It in no way diminishes, but on the contrary, definitely increases the power of our long-distance blockade. Similarly, the entrance of Italy into the war increases the power of our long-distance blockade. We stop the worst leak of all by that. We do not know whether military resistance will come to an end in France or not. But should it do so, then, of course, the Germans will be able to concentrate their forces, both military and later on industrial, upon us. But for the reasons I've given you a little earlier in these remarks, they will not find it easy to apply their military forces to this island in great strength. If invasion has become more imminent, as no doubt it has, we, being relieved from the task of maintaining a large army in France, have far stronger and more efficient forces here to meet it. If Hitler can bring under his despotic control the industries of the countries he's conquered, this will add greatly to his already vast armament output. On the other hand, he will not be able to develop them immediately. And we are now assured of immense, continuous, increasing support in supplies and munitions of all kinds from the United States, and especially of aeroplanes and pilots from the Dominions and across the ocean, outside the reach of the enemy bomber. I do not see how any of the new factors, the new adverse factors I have mentioned, can operate to our detriment on the balance before the winter comes. And the winter will impose a strain upon the Nazi regime, with almost all Europe writhing and starving under its cruel heel, which for all their ruthlessness will run them very hard. We must not forget that from the moment that we declared war on September the 3rd, and you heard that first air raid warning within a few minutes of the declaration of war, we must not forget that it was always possible for Germany to turn all her air force upon this country, together with any other devices of invasion and darn tricks and stratagems she had in mind. And France could do little or nothing to prevent her doing so. We have therefore lived under this danger all these months. In the meanwhile, however, we've enormously improved our methods of defense, and we have learned what we had no right to claim at the beginning, namely that the individual aircraft and the individual British pilot has assured and definite superiority. Therefore, in casting up this dread balance sheet, seeing our dangers with a disillusioned eye, I see great reason for intense exertion and vigilance
but none whatever for panic or despair. During the last 4 years, during the first four years of the last war, 1914 to 1918, the Allies experienced nothing but disaster and disappointment. That was our constant fare. One blow after another, and terrible losses, and frightful dangers. Everything miscarried. And yet, at the end of those 4 years, the morale of the Allies was higher than that of the Germans, who had moved from one aggressive triumph to another, and who stood everywhere triumphant invaders of the lands into which they had broken. During that war, we repeatedly asked ourselves this question: how are we going to win? And I do not remember that anyone was ever able to answer it with much precision, until at the end, quite suddenly and unexpectedly, our terrible foe collapsed before us. And we were so gorged and glutted with victory that in our folly we threw it all away. We do not know yet what will happen in France, or whether the French resistance will be prolonged, both in France and in the French Empire overseas, or whether it will only be prolonged in the French Empire overseas. The French government will be throwing away great opportunities and casting adrift their future if they do not continue the war in accordance with their treaty obligations, from which we have not felt able to release them. I dare say you saw in the newspapers this morning the historic declaration in which, at the desire of many Frenchmen and of our own hearts, we have proclaimed our willingness at this darkest hour in French history to conclude a union of common citizenship in this struggle. However matters may go in France, or with the French government, or other French governments, we in this island and in the British Empire will never lose our sense of comradeship with the French people if we are now called upon to endure what they have been suffering. We shall emulate their courage, and if final victory rewards our toils, they shall share the gain. Aye, more, freedom shall be restored to all. We abate nothing of our just demands. Not one jot or tittle do we recede. Czechs, Poles, Norwegians, Dutch, and Belgians have joined the causes with our own. All these shall be restored. What General Weygand has called the Battle of France is over. The Battle of Britain is about to begin. Upon this battle depends the survival of Christian civilization. Upon it depends our own British life and the long continuity of our institutions and our empire. The whole fury and might of the enemy must very soon be turned on us. Hitler knows that he will have to break us in this island or lose the war. If we can stand up to him, all Europe may be freed, and the life of the world may move forward into broad, sunlit upland. But if we fail, then the whole world, including the United States, including all that we have known and cared for, will sink into the abyss of a new dark age, made more sinister and perhaps more protracted by the lights of perverted science. Let us therefore brace ourselves to our duty, and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealths last for 1,000 years,
men will still say, this was their finest hour.
During the last fortnight, the British Navy, in addition to blockading what is left of the German fleet and chasing the Italian fleet, has had imposed upon it the sad duty of putting effectually out of action for the duration of the war the capital ships of the French Navy. These, under the armistice terms signed in the railway coach at Compiègne, would have been placed within the power of Nazi Germany. The transference of these ships to Hitler would have endangered the security both of Great Britain and the United States. We therefore had no choice but to act as we did, and to act forthwith. Our painful task is now completed. Although the unfinished battleship, the Jean Bart, still rests in a Moroccan harbor, and there are a number of French warships at Toulon and in various French ports all over the world, these are not in a condition or of a character to derange our preponderance of naval power. As long, therefore, as they make no attempt to return to ports controlled by Germany or Italy, we shall not molest them in any way. That melancholy phase in our relations with France has, so far as we are concerned, come to an end. Let us think rather of the future. Today is the 14th of July, the National Festival of France. A year ago in Paris, I watched the stately parade down the Champs-Élysées of the French army and the French Empire. Who could foresee what the course of a year would bring? Who can foresee what the course of other years will bring? Faith is given to us as a help and comfort when we stand in awe before the unfurling scroll of human destiny. And I proclaim my faith that some of us will live to see a 14th of July, when a liberated France will once again rejoice in her greatness and in her glory, and once again stand forward as the champion of the freedom and the rights of man. When that day dawns, as dawn it will, the soul of France will turn with comprehension and with kindness to those Frenchmen and French women, wherever they may be, who in the darkest hour did not despair of the Republic. In the meantime, we shall not waste our breath or cumber our thought with reproaches. When you have a friend and comrade at whose side you have faced tremendous struggles, and your friend is smitten down by a stunning blow, it may be necessary to make sure that the weapon that has fallen from his hands shall not be added to the resources of your common enemy. But you need not bear malice because of your friend's cries of delirium and gestures of agony. You must not add to his pain. You must work for his recovery. The association of interest between Britain and France remains. The cause remains. Duty inescapable remains. So long as our pathway to victory is not impeded, we are ready to discharge such offices of goodwill towards the French government as may be possible, and to foster the trade and help the administration of those parts of the great French Empire
which are now cut off from captive France, but which maintain their freedom. Subject to the iron demands of the war, which we are waging against Hitler and all his works, we shall try so to conduct ourselves that every true French heart will beat and glow at the way we carry on the struggle, and that not only France, but all the oppressed countries in Europe may feel that each British victory is a step towards the liberation of the continent from the foulest thraldom into which it has ever been cast. All goes to show that the war will be long and hard. No one can tell where it will spread. One thing is certain, the peoples of Europe will not be ruled for long by the Nazi Gestapo, nor will the world yield itself to Hitler's gospel of hatred, appetite, and domination. And now it has come to us to stand alone in the breach and face the worst that the tyrant's might and enmity can do. Bearing ourselves humbly before God, but conscious that we serve an unfolding purpose, we are ready to defend our native land against the invasion by which it is threatened. We are fighting by ourselves alone, but we are not fighting for ourselves alone. Here in this strong city of refuge, which enshrines the title deeds of human progress and is of deep consequence to Christian civilization, here, girt about by the seas and oceans, where the navy reigns, shielded from above by the prowess and airmen, we await undismayed the impending assault. Perhaps it will come tonight. Perhaps it will come next week. Perhaps it will never come. We must show ourselves equally capable of meeting a sudden violent shock, or what is perhaps a harder test, a prolonged vigil. But be the ordeal sharp or long, or both, we shall seek no terms, we shall tolerate no parley, we may show mercy, we shall ask none. I can easily understand how sympathetic onlookers across the Atlantic, or anxious friends in the yet unravaged countries of Europe, who cannot measure our resources or our resolve, may have feared for our survival when they saw so many states and kingdoms torn to pieces in a few weeks or even days by the monstrous force of the Nazi war machine. But Hitler has not yet been withstood by a great nation with a willpower the equal of his own. Many of these countries have been poisoned by intrigue before they were struck down by violence. They have been rotted from within before they were smitten from without. What has happened to France, to the French army, to the French people, to the leaders of the French people. But here, in our island, we are in good health and in good heart. We have seen how Hitler prepared in scientific detail the plans for destroying the neighbor countries of Germany. He had his plans for Poland and his plans for Norway. He had his plans for Denmark. He had his plans all worked out for the doom of the peaceful, trustful Dutch, and of course for the Belgians. We have seen how the French were undermined and overthrown. We may therefore be sure that there is a plan, perhaps built up over years, for destroying Great Britain, which, after all, has the honor to be his main and foremost enemy. All I can say is that any plan for invading Britain, which Hitler made 2 months ago, must have had to be entirely recast in order to meet our new position. 2 months ago, nay, 1 month ago, our first and main effort was to keep our best army in France, all our regular troops, all our output of munitions, and a very large part of our air force had to be sent to France and maintained in action there. But now we have it all at home. Never before in the last war, or in this, have we had in this island an army comparable in quality, equipment, or numbers to that which stands here on guard tonight. We have 1.5 million men in the British Army under arms tonight. And every week of June and July has seen their organization, their defenses, and their striking power advance by leaps and bounds. No praise is too high for the officers and men, aye, and civilians, who have made this immense transformation in so short a time. Behind these soldiers of the regular army, as a means of destruction for parachutists, airborne invaders, and any traitors that may be found in our midst, and I do not believe there are many, woe betide them, they will get short shrift. Behind the regular army, we have more than 1 million of the local defense volunteers, or as they are much better called, the Home Guard. These officers and men, a large proportion of whom have been through the last war, have the strongest desire to attack and come to close quarters with the enemy, wherever he may appear. Should the invader come to Britain, there will be no placid lying down of the people in submission before him, as we have seen, alas, in other countries. We shall defend every village, every town, and every city. The vast mass of London itself, fought street by street, could easily devour an entire hostile army. And we would rather see London laid in ruins and ashes than that it should be tamely and abjectly enslaved. I am bound to state these facts because it is necessary to inform our people of our intentions, and thus to reassure them. This has been a great week for the Royal Air Force and for the Fighter Command. They have shut down more than 5-1 of the German aircraft which have tried to molest our convoys in the Channel or have ventured to cross the British coastline. Of course, only the preliminary encounters to the great air battles which lie ahead. But I know of no reason why we should be discontented with the results so far achieved, although, of course, we hope to improve upon them as the fighting becomes more widespread and comes more inland. Around all lies the power of the Royal Navy. With over 1,000 armed ships under the White Ensign patrolling the seas, the Navy, which is capable of transferring its force very readily to the protection of any part of the British Empire which may be threatened, which is capable also of keeping open our communication with the New World, from whom, as the struggle deepens, increasing aid will come. Is it not remarkable that after 10 months of unlimited U-boat and air attack upon our commerce, that our food reserves are higher than they have ever been, and that we have a substantially larger tonnage under our own flag, apart from great numbers of foreign ships in our control, than we had at the beginning of the war? Why do I dwell on all this? Not surely to induce any slackening of effort or vigilance. On the contrary, these must be redoubled, and we must prepare not only for the summer, but for the winter. Not only for 1941, but for 1942, when the war will, I trust, take a different form from the defensive in which it has hitherto been bound. I dwell on these elements in our strength, on these resources which we have mobilized and control. I dwell on it and them, because it is right to show that the good cause can command the means of survival. and that while we toil through the dark valley, we can see the sunlight on the upland beyond. I stand at the head of a government representing all parties in the state, all creeds, all classes, every recognizable section of opinion. We are ranged beneath the crown of our ancient monarchy. We are supported by a free parliament and a free press. But there is one bond which unites us all and sustains us in the public regard, namely, as is increasingly becoming known, that we are prepared to proceed to all extremities, to endure them and to enforce them. That is our bond of union in His Majesty's government tonight. Thus only, in times like these, can nations preserve their freedom, and thus only can they uphold the cause entrusted to their care. But all depends now upon the whole life strength of the British race, all our associated peoples, and of all our well-wishers in every land, doing their utmost night and day, giving all, daring all, enduring all, to the utmost, to the end. It is no war of chieftains or of princes, of dynasties or national ambitions. It is a war of peoples and of causes. There are vast numbers, not only in this island, but in every land, who will render faithful service in this war, but whose names will never be known, whose deeds will never be recorded. This is a war of the unknown warriors. But let all strive without failing, in faith or in duty, and the dark curse of Hitler will be lifted from our age.
Herzlich willkommen im Nürburgring. Eins, zwei, drei.
gonna push on through the night. By Sunday night, you know it's gonna be alright.
Und wie geht es jetzt aus?
Bubbling, 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 bub
Truly love me, you would change everything for me. I'm with you always.